Mr. Ackerman, thank you very much for taking my interview today. A Russian rocket struck the western Ukrainian city of Lviv on March 26, while President Biden was visiting neighboring Poland. You were in Lviv that day, covering for Time magazine. So please tell us what you've witnessed on the ground when and after the bombing happened.
Well, you know, rockets have been consistently falling on most major Ukrainian cities, to include Lviv, although the rocketing there has not been as intense as cities in the east. That being said, probably on any given day, there will be at least 2 to 3 air raid warnings in Lviv, where everyone has to go down into a bomb shelter. So that day in the afternoon, the rockets struck just to the north of the city at an oil refinery. And when you came out from the bomb shelter, you could see, you know, thick black clouds of smoke billowing up and hovering over the city.
You also visited Kyiv. So how was people holding up over there? What impressed you the most?
Kyiv, given the degree of fighting that's gone on there, is very tense. There is a heightened security presence on all of the streets. The streets are also heavily defended with sandbag barricade and army outposts. So Kyiv has really seen, you know, some pretty intense fighting on the outskirts, and at any given time you can hear outgoing artillery as well as those exchanges happening in some of the suburbs around Kyiv.
As the conflict moved into a second month, Russian forces have largely failed in their first aim to take the largest cities. As a former intelligence officer, do you believe the, you know, Russia's stalled advance was partly because of Putin's intelligence failure or miscalculation?
This Russian intelligence failure is a huge part of why the Russian army has had such a difficult time in Ukraine. The Russians fundamentally underestimated the Ukrainians, did not understand the depth and passion of Ukrainian resolve. These people's desire to live in their own free, independent country. And it would seem there was an assumption on the part of the Russians that they would be able to inspire divisions in Ukraine and, so divided, be able to at least annex a good chunk of the country, if not the whole country. And that is just absolutely not proven the case. You know, the very big story here is the resolve of the Ukrainians.
You once compared the centralized command and control used by the Russian military and the decentralized mission-style command and control used by the Ukrainian forces. Would you please elaborate on this? How does it play out in the fact that Russia had such a difficult time gaining ground?
At a fundamental level, the Russian army and the Western NATO armies have very different philosophies in how they wage war. And this goes all the way back decades, if not centuries, Soviet times and before. In so much as, you know, Western militaries rely on what are called mission style tactics, meaning everyone from a 22-year-old corporal up to a general understands deeply the mission, why they're there, what they're trying to achieve. And the reason for that is that when command and control breaks down, when in the chaos of war, if everyone understands the mission, even if the plan isn't working and nothing is going according to plan, and even if people can't talk, if everyone understands the mission, they can adapt to get the mission done, to complete the mission. So that's mission style tactics. You know, the Russians have a very centralized command structure where all decision making is made in one place, where plans are very tightly orchestrated and choreographed. And that can work well if everything is going according to plan. But the weakness of that system is that when things don't go according to plan, the junior soldiers don't have a good idea of why they're there, what their mission is. And you quickly see chaos develop when you have that centralized planning structure, as we've seen in Ukraine. And I think a great example of this was, if we remember early on after the Russian invasion, there was a 40-mile-long convoy leading down to Kyiv. And that convoy that was 40 miles sitting there was really a traffic jam. And there was a breakdown amongst the Russian command and control when things didn't go according to plan, where none of these vehicles knew what they were supposed to do. And so we're really seeing in Ukraine today two diametrically opposed philosophies of warfare engaging with one another. And the Ukrainians, with their mission-style tactics are doing far, far better than the Russians.
Given that, if the fight descended into a guerrilla war, as some analysts predict, will it give Ukraine a greater edge?
I'm very skeptical that it will devolve into a guerrilla war. I think one of the challenges that we're having in the West right now is we perpetually keep underestimating the Ukrainians and overestimating the Russians. And we seem very reluctant, despite a month of continual battlefield successes, to just say what is glaringly obvious. The Ukrainians are winning this war. And so far, it appears that they're winning it pretty handily. If you know, they'll still need support from the West in terms of weapons and materiel to keep pressure on the Russians. But they have certainly shown themselves more capable of fighters than the Russians. In the event, which I believe is unlikely, that this would sort of have to devolve into a guerrilla-style war, I think you would see the Ukrainians as highly effective guerrilla fighters.
How do you see the role played by anti-armor weapons in the Ukraine-Russia war, particularly the American-made weapons like Javelin?
Well, we're seeing for the first time the wide-scale deployment of some of these new generation anti-tank missiles like the Javelin or the British-made NLAW, and they're incredibly effective against the latest generation tanks. And that is something new. In the past, maybe 15 or even 20 years ago, the latest generation tanks, by and large, their armor was effective enough to protect them from anti-tank weapons. These new anti-tank weapons, that's not the case. And that's why we're seeing time after time Russian tanks, very advanced Russian tanks, being destroyed by small groups of two or three Ukrainians. And that is that's an important trend in this war that everyone should pay attention to. The Russians should pay attention to it, but the United States and NATO should be paying attention to it as well, because particularly in the West, we have what I would call a very platform-centric view of warfare, meaning we tend to invest very heavily in these extremely expensive platforms like technologically advanced battle tanks or ships or aircraft. And what we're seeing is that anti-platform weapons now have the capacity to destroy these very expensive, very advanced platform systems.
So you think the superiority of anti-armor weapons displayed in this war could change warfare tactics in future wars?
I think it could certainly change the balance of power, because it's not just anti-tank missiles that we're seeing the effectiveness of. You know, it's also anti-ship missiles. And so if a military is completely invested in its platforms, while at the same time the anti-platform technologies like these missiles become extremely advanced, you could very quickly see one military that's perceived to be weaker become the stronger. And in many respects, that's what we've seen in Ukraine. You know, the Ukrainians do not have many tanks, yet they're defeating Russian tanks. And it's not with their own tanks, it's with these Javelin missiles. So that's an important, I think that's an important trend to be paying attention to.
Sure. As you point out, the anti-armor weapons have proved to be able to turn the tide for an outmatched military. Is it applicable to possible conflicts in some other places, like in the South China Sea or across Taiwan Strait?
I think it certainly is. It's that same idea of the ascendance of anti-platform weapon systems. So, for instance, shore-based missiles we're seeing have now extended ranges and extended lethality. So in any type of naval clash, like one you could imagine seeing in the South China Sea, it would show that there would be an increased level of vulnerability to large groups of capital ships like aircraft carriers and destroyers. So it's an important trend, again, for, you know, not only the Chinese military, but also the American military to watch as they're making decisions on how to invest their resources.
As a former Marine who served five tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, has the Ukraine-Russia war refreshed or changed your view on war?
Well, I think one of the things that I have observed is that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan frequently were complex morally. The Iraq war was fought on faulty premises. The Afghan war dragged on for years and years. Oftentimes, what we were doing there didn't seem particularly clear. That is not the case in Ukraine. In Ukraine, the stakes are very clear. There is very clearly one side that is in the right here, the Ukrainians, and another side that is the aggressor and in the wrong, and that is the Russians. And so I've been engaged with war for 20 years. This is the fourth war that I've been to. I also covered Syria as a journalist, and it's the most clear-cut war that I have seen in terms of which side we should all be on and who we should all be supporting, and that is the side of the Ukrainians.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Ackerman.